So they want to live to 150 years, but not us. No, it's not fair. We'll be back with John Rappaport. We'll talk more about his work, The Ownership of All Life, on Coast to Coast AM. John, you were talking about genetically manipulated and altered cold soldiers, you were saying.
Yes. This researcher was saying to me, there's going to be four classes of people in the plan for the new human. And the first one we covered, the second one he called the cold warrior. He said, this is feel no pain, feel no feelings. This is soldier time, the new soldier. He said, at that point, we would be talking about a government corporate alliance to create kind of military intelligence persona human being that would simply be, you know, almost virtually impervious to feelings or pain, would have tremendous endurance, carry out missions, and so on and so forth.
That's dangerous.
Very. The third, he said, is going to be compliant citizens, people that are genetically programmed to behave, to follow orders, to do the
drones
that everybody else does.
Will be the workers, right?
The workers. And then finally, he said, you'll have the phase-outs. Those are the people that won't be programmed at all. And there will be certain restrictions so that they don't produce another generation. He said, this is where it's heading. And he said, if you want to look at it in more general terms, you're looking at the split of humanity into two, the haves and the have-nots.
Yes.
The bigs and the smalls and so on and so forth. And he said the ownership of these genes will be promoted as a government corporate alliance. Some of the genes will be owned by the government, and we've already seen that this is true, some by corporate. They will gobble up as many sequences and separate genes and clusters of genes as they possibly can. This is already happening. And he said, on the social front, genes are already being used and will continue to be used to reduce the idea of personal choice, freedom, and responsibility, because people will be propagandized and programmed by the media to think, I'm not responsible, it's all in my genes. I don't have to do anything in particular, that is, I'm not responsible for my actions and my choices. Freedom is not something that's really real. It's all about genetics. And so the best I can do is to look forward to the day when maybe I can have some enhancements or my kids can have enhancements. He said, you will see in this sense a world created of, and the phrase he used was, victims of our genes. That's the way it'll play out on the social plateau. And, of course, we're beginning to see this already. People have this sense that that's the way it is.
Sure. What happened to the humanitarian plan, John? And that was, let's cure diseases.
Well, exactly. That will continue, but as we've discussed,
it's the front.
It's a front. And so it doesn't really matter whether the cures come through or not, or if they're spotty, or if they're horrendous side effects in many experiments and so on and so forth. Studies will be published. Proclamations will be made. Oh, we've, you know, made a great advance when it comes to cancer of this or that or heart disease. It'll be basically a propaganda campaign backed up by, medical studies. And he said, look, if some of this turns out to be real and useful, great, it'll happen. He said, but he said, what I am so upset about, and he really was upset because he was trapped, is the program behind the program. He said, this, what I'm talking to you about is what's really going on. This is what the plan is. This is the way it is. And then I said, well, listen, here's something I don't understand. You've got these corporations that are accumulating massive amounts of money, mm-hmm. biotech corporations, so forth. They're not turning out anything really useful. I mean, how can they continue to exist? He said, well, look, first of all, some of them have already been gobbled up by larger companies, pharmaceutical companies, chemical companies, et cetera. And that will continue to go on. He said, because look at it this way. If you're a gigantic chemical company, what's one of the biggest things you're worried about? Lawsuits because you polluted some area with horrendous chemicals and now you're facing, you know, billion-dollar judgments against you. He said, now, suppose you, sitting in the boardroom of this corporation, start to figure out what's the 50-year cost risk benefit of paying out those gigantic court judgments for polluting, as opposed to being able to float the idea in front of a jury or a judge that the only people that are really dying or getting sick in these situations are genetically predisposed in that direction already.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can produce that kind of propaganda result, it's worth all that wasted money compared to what you would have to pay out for environmental disasters. And he said, we're getting closer to that day when you're going to be able to make that argument in a courtroom and say, look, you know, yeah, you're talking about all these people dying of cancer in this small town of California. Well, let's look at the 150 cases here, and let's see the other 150 that didn't get cancer. And we're going to present to you genetic evidence that shows that it's really all about the genes.
That's right. It's not our fault.
Not our fault. I mean, it's just these people are predisposed. So that was pretty fantastic. And then 2 years later, out comes a book, Remaking Eden, Cloning and Beyond in a Brave New World, written by Lee Silver, who is a professor at Princeton Department of Molecular Biology, Woodrow Wilson School for Public and International Affairs. And this, to me, was the capper. Now, this is not, I'm not trying to launch a crusade against Lee Silver. My sense is that the man is a political libertarian, but here's what he says, and this is exactly in line with what this third scientist told me. In a few hundred years, the gen rich, he calls them, the genetically rich, who account for 10% of the American population, will all carry synthetic genes. All aspects of the economy, the media, the entertainment industry, and the knowledge industry will be controlled by members of the gen rich class. That means genetically enhanced people. Naturals will work as low-paid service providers or as laborers. Eventually, the gen-rich class and the natural class will become entirely separate species with no ability to crossbreed and with as much romantic interest in each other as current human would have for a chimpanzee. In a society that values individual freedom above all else, it is hard to find any legitimate basis for restricting the use of reprogenetics, as he calls it. The use of reprogenetic technologies is inevitable. There is no doubt about it. Whether we like it or not, the global marketplace will reign supreme.
John, it's unbelievable that this would be happening. Now, we know a number of doctors who are good, dedicated people. Can they stop this?
I think they could. That's a great question, George. I believe that they could if they were to band together and stand up as a group. But how many times have we seen that happen? I can't really start even to count because they don't do that. They feel isolated within their lab, their university, wherever the money is coming from, whoever employs them. They know they're going to lose their jobs for sure. They're going to be blackballed in that industry forever. They would have to stand up together. But if they made a loud enough noise, and if they were doctors or PhD researchers, and they said, hey, we've got to look at what's happening here, they could change things. They absolutely could. And what we're seeing here, you see, this is all going mainstream now, George. There's this book that I just quoted from. I mean, I've got quotes spread out here all over my table from, you know, director of the program on medicine, technology, and society at UCLA, talking here about, bioethicist, producer of a public affairs program, secretary of the World Transhumanist Association. I mean, publishing. All of this is now going mainstream. These people who are telling us that this is the future, that this is where we're going. this is no longer being held under the, in the dark. The thing that is being held in the dark is what we're talking about here, is how it's going to play out, how we're going to have different classes of humans. But in the statement that I just read, you can see that he's even, making that very clear. This is where it's going. You're going to have the genetically enhanced, and then you're going to have everybody else. It's astonishing to me that it is so mainstream now, and that nobody in power is really saying anything about it. There are court cases being fought about who owns the genes. But as far as this agenda is concerned, there is no medical biological hero who is standing up the way, say, Peter Bregenz has been standing up, a psychiatrist who writes about his own profession and the toxicity of the drugs and so on and so forth. There's nobody like that that I know of who's right in the middle of his own profession that is standing up and, becoming a hero.
Well, we see, they're genetically altering food. They're genetically altering animals. They must be genetically altering people right now, beyond whatever experiments the Nazis might have been doing. It's got to be going on now.
I believe that's absolutely true. I've searched and searched to find instances of it. My conclusion right now is it's happening on some level wherever there is sufficient coercion to isolate people. For example, prisons. Prisons have a very long history of medical experimentation, and some of it is so bizarre, so cruel, so horrendous that, it's hard for an ordinary person to even accept it. But it's been going on for a long time, and it continues to go on in the United States and other countries. Or if you've got a situation, let's say, in a slave trade environment, wherever people are imprisoned, where held against their will, you've got the potential and the actuality of these kind of experiments and how far they're actually going. I mean, I've read claims that I can't confirm, so I'm not bringing them on board here, but I agree with you. It's already happening. They're already trying it out. And the way that you have to try this out, everybody has to understand here, is by chance, because they don't know enough to be able to say, oh, we're sure that if we introduce this gene, we're going to get this result. They have no idea. So we're talking about Russian roulette here, the kind of experimentation where you say, all right, let's try this and see what happens. And then you get some horrendous outcome in the person. Just freakish, horrible outcome in terms of behavior, disease, who knows what, scrambling of the nervous system, the genes are all messed up. Okay, well, that didn't work. Let's try this. Because that's the way they have to go, because they don't know. What they're looking at as a result of the Human Genome Project, which determined, right or wrong, that humans have about 22,000 genes, is they're looking at a gigantic puzzle with all the pieces thrown around on a gigantic table. And if you read carefully statements that have been made by some of the top people that were involved in that project, they will admit that they don't know. They just don't know. They don't know why there's so much junk DNA. They don't know which genes create what effects. They don't know whether they do them in concert with each other or singly. They just don't know. So the only way to proceed is to guess.
And though, if they create these people, these classes that you talked about, there's got to be a shutoff switch involved. Because these cold soldiers, for example, what's to stop them from getting together en masse and saying, they can't stop us, we have no pain, we're going to run this country or this planet. There's got to be a kill switch somewhere that they're going to develop and not tell the person about it.
Absolutely. I would say there's no question about it. They're going to try to build that in so that you've got people who are, basically following orders. And if you try to break ranks, then the result is, something horrendous that you can't stand.
They exterminate you.
Yeah, you don't do it or you die. I mean, Blade Runner had some very interesting things in it, that movie that was made based on Philip Dick's short story. I mean, we're talking about, you know, whatever it was, sixth, seventh generation replicants, as they called them, you know, that were bordering on being human, but obviously were not, because they were still controlled. So this was projecting this kind of future. And this plan is intact from all the information I was able to gather, especially from these interviews with insiders who were distraught. I mean, to one degree or another, very distraught to have discovered what they were really wrapped up in and where this was going. And I said to one of these guys, how is it concealed? He said, it's so simple. It's just a matter of compartmentalization. I said, you get somebody working on X over here and Y over there and Z in another lab over there. They're being paid to turn out work. They don't have time to try to look around and figure things out. You know, it's an exceptional person that will stop and do that. But when all that information that they come up with is collated, somebody else can take that at another level and use it for another purpose. So that's the way that the game works. That's how it can be concealed. And then, of course, you have these kinds of experimental facilities where everybody knows what's going on and they are, you know, paid to keep quiet, and they just do insane experiments like the kind that went on in the Nazi era or the kind that have gone on in prisons in the United States.
It's kind of sad, John, isn't it? It's sad that it's happening, that people would even have to think about that. What, and that brings up the big question. Why? Why do they want to do this? Why do they want to screw around with Mother Nature, alter humans? We've been here since the beginning of our time. Why change it?
You know, in my 30 years researching, writing, I run into people who are such extreme idealists in the worst sense of that word. It's something in their psychology. They can't be satisfied with life. And I don't mean that you just have to sit down and accept things as they are, and quite to the contrary, but the whole sense of the richness and the variations of life all around them are intolerable. So they promote some super ideal, which is perfectly recognizable. I mean, the case history of the Nazi regime is exactly that. They couldn't stop. They had to go to this other place. You know, what makes the Inquisition of the you know, medieval and part of the Renaissance period happen? How can those people have done that? They have some kind of perverted idealism that prevents them from being able to live and accept life in all of its richness. There's something, you know, there's just something wrong with these people. And unfortunately, they gain power. And other people are willing to follow them on the basis of some kind of promise because, you know, the bulk of humanity is in a position where they want to escape from the condition that they're in.
Sure.
Right? So somebody comes along and promises the sky, and it's like a magnet. It's going to be a certain number of people that are going to follow until and if they ever find out what the real agenda is. But I agree with you. It's a mystery as to, you know, why. But that's the way I see it. And I have met people like this. And they can't accept themselves as they are. They have to, and I mean with tremendous potential. I don't just mean as drones. That's not good enough. There has to be some huge amount of control involved. We want to rigidify things.
We'd maybe reduce the population?
Absolutely reduce the population as a way of doing this, because that is the twin program here.
Hey, John, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come back and talk about genetically modified foods. That fits into this program as well. I want to get your take on that. And then we'll take phone calls next hour. Right here on Coast to Coast AM, I'm George Norrie. Well, you can be a Coast Insider, formerly Streamlink, for just 25 cents a day, a little less in some cases, where you get downloads, podcasting, and just have some downright fun. And they're still working on that app, by the way, for Android. The iPhone app is in and ready to go and has been up there for some time. The Android app, they're trying to figure out. They get close, then they get a step back. So patience there. I guess we were also talking about the possibility of just maybe bypassing that app and developing our own, which is a probability, too. So don't toss that out. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. John Rappaport, our special guest, will take phone calls with John next hour. John, genetically modified foods, they continue, even in Europe, they got slapped down a little bit. They thought they could fight it. It doesn't appear that they can successfully. What's happening in that arena?
Well, I know that right now at the Codex Alimentarius, which is an agency under the World Health Organization, there's a battle going on. I spoke with Scott Tibbs, who's representative for the National Health Federation, which is a delegate, a non-government delegate at these meetings. He goes all over the world. They have a petition, actually, on their website about labeling at the National Health Federation. And it's a battle to see if they're going to say you've got to label foods genetically modified or not. Right now, he estimates that it's sort of a 50-50 proposition because there are still European countries that want that labeling to happen. But the battle has not been decided, and it could go against us. There's all kinds of things that could happen.
And, of course, the reason why the industry is opposed to this labeling the food is because they figure nobody's going to buy it, right?
Yeah, they know. They know that people are going to say, well, no thanks. You know, polls show that people, when they're informed, they walk away from it. So that tells you something right there. As of 2002, there were six agrochemical companies that held over 900 patents on varieties of the basic staple foods of the planet. That means patents on the seeds and genes that would be inserted in these foods. And that's, you know, 9 years ago. And their intention is obviously to make all food crops genetically modified. That's what they're going to do.
That's how they make their money.
That is how they make their money, exactly. And, you know, it's a juggernaut. There was a statement made many years ago by a man named Val Giddings, who I believe at the time was at Monsanto, and he said, it's inevitable. All food is going to be GMO, genetically modified. It's going to happen. There's no way to stop it.
Some marketing genius one day in some meeting probably said, you know what? Farmers are using their own seeds every year. Every year. I mean, there's no money. How are we going to be able to corner that market? So under the auspices of insect-resistant seeds, seeds that can use special herbicides, they decided, let's come up with a seed that you can only use once, and you got to buy it again next year and next year. And just think of the money we can make. In terms of pure marketing, somebody came up with that. I guarantee you that's how it started, John.
I'm sure that it is. Just the way a pharmaceutical company will say, let's look at the market here and let's see if we can define a new disorder.
Yes, we need a new disease, and then we can sell a new product for it.
Same theory, same thinking. That's the way they operate. You know, the neem tree in India, which was Gandhi's favorite tree, either right now or at least for many years, was held under patent by the W.R. Grace Company because they were going to develop a biopesticide. And so what that means is that if somebody in India decides to use that tree for a similar purpose or any part of that tree, then they have to pay a royalty or they have to apply for permission. I mean, this is like an eternal tree that's been growing in India forever. It's the same mindset, the same program that we've been talking about when it comes to human genetics. They look at this and they say, we can make it better. We can corner the market on it. We can make billions of dollars on it, and it will be better. Even if it isn't better, it'll be better. Even if there are problems, even if there are horrendous side effects, even if the nutritional value of the food crops is lower, even if The plant is not always resistant to the pesticide as we said it would be, even if new insects begin to show up and destroy the crops. It's still better. It has to be better because we say it's better. And so they sweep all of the, just the way pharmaceutical companies do, all of the, quote, adverse effects under the carpet. And they say, it's a lifesaver, it's wonderful, this is the future. Small farmer is out, big farmer is in, and you've got to buy the seeds every year. And if they blow onto your property from somewhere else and you use them, well, you owe us money.
Unbelievable, isn't it?
It is. It's just, I mean, because here we're talking about something that everybody understands to be nature. People for millennia have found seeds, grown seeds, sorted out which ones produce the best food in small farms all over the world. They save the seeds. They share them with their neighbors. You know, I mean, this is the way of the world. And then all of a sudden, somebody comes in and says no. And it's not as if there's these companies, which really, they're chemical companies, they're pharmaceutical companies, they're genetic engineering companies. The biggest of these pretty much have all three divisions wrapped up in one company. And these companies come along and they say, no, no, that's not the way the world is. And not only that, but we're not going to compete with you. We're not going to just say, look, we're offering an alternative we think is better. No, no, we're going to monopolize the market so that you have no other choice.
The idea of human genetics is not new. If you look at the Sumerian cylinders, as the late Zachariah Sitchin once did, John, and interpreted the Sumerians as simply saying that we had been visited by extraterrestrials and we have been genetically manipulated, genetically altered. What do you think of that?
Well, I've looked up some statements about that. I mean, I know a little bit about Sitchin's work. We were involved for a while with the same publisher. The statements that I've read, for example, from Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of, the DNA shape, so to speak, the helix, they're saying, look, we don't understand this at all. This doesn't make a kind of simple sense, this whole genetic structure. It's too brilliant. It's too fantastic. It's too interlocked. It's obviously in some way designed. And what they're really hinting at here is that they don't believe that it would be formed by Darwinian evolution. They don't see that happening. Now, they don't come out and say that because, you know, they get drummed out of the core for that. But that's what they're thinking. They're thinking a puddle of, of mud and amino acids, and out of that came life, and out of that came this incredibly complex genetic code. No, no, no. And then we have all this DNA that appears to be so-called junk DNA, about which we know less than zero. What is its purpose? It doesn't seem to code anything at all. This must have been designed somewhere else, or the possibility is that it was designed somewhere else. A number of scientists have come out and said this. So, to me, it makes kind of sense. I mean, it's a reasonable proposition, for sure, that this could have happened. Because when you look at the puzzle, it just doesn't seem to be the kind of thing where you would say, oh, yeah, you know, first we had the amoeba, then we had this, and the bacteria, and the human, and so forth. And yeah, we can see how all this happened. And it doesn't appear to be like that at all.
And if that happened, so here we are now, hundreds of thousands of years later, trying to do what they might have done to us a long time ago.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We're repeating the same insanity, which maybe is a kind of answer to that question that you asked earlier, which was why? Why would anybody want to do this? Well, we know that from our experience as a human race, I mean, we repeat history's mistakes over and over and over and over as if there's some compulsion to do that, even though we sense that the result is going to be horrific. So maybe that's real. We're doing what was done to us. we're now thinking that this is what we need to do. Only, obviously, we're in a lower position on the food chain, so to speak, in doing it than those who did it to us, if that's what really happened. I could see that. I could definitely see that, that would be the case, as insane as it is to be thinking that way. But, you know, one of the things that comes across to me very vividly here is that once you're all said and done at looking at the genome and the genes and what little we know about it and the intricacy of the structure and so on and so forth, I can't avoid coming to the conclusion that there is a non-material aspect to life that is far more important than any of that. Because if we solidly get into the camp of, look, this is all we are, this is, you know, this is it, baby. You got your genetic structure, that's who you are, what you will be, what your kids will be. There's nothing beyond that. That, to me, is the most insane kind of reasoning at all, of all. It just, it doesn't click. It doesn't make any sense, which then leaves the idea that, no, there are levels of thought, there are levels of capacity that we have, there are levels of all kinds of things, imagination, creativity, and so forth. You can't link to any of this stuff. It goes beyond it into other realms. It goes into energies that are not part of this genome, and it goes beyond even energies into a non-material aspect of ourselves that, if we were to understand it more fully, would put us way beyond any of this craziness that we're involved in.
You and I started talking a long time ago about the H1N1 virus, the bird flu, SARS. We got into all that, and we both said at that time, John, there is not going to be a pandemic. This is a bunch of malarkey, and we were right.
Yeah, we were.
We were right.
We were right.
One day, they're going to release something on us, and I just don't know when. But I think it's going to happen. What about you?
Something you mean that really does produce a pandemic?
Yeah. Yeah. And it will be man-made. It'll be created.
Well, I would go this far. If they do, it will be man-made. They will have tested it out beforehand to see that it actually does what they want it to do. Those will be a series of really horrendous experiments. And then they will say, okay, here we go. But there would have to be a tremendous amount of preparation for that because of the chaos that would ensue. And I think, and I've been saying this for a very long time, that the probability is that they would do it in a restricted area and they would use a chemical rather than a germ, because they can predict the effects of a chemical. Only they would call it a germ because they know, George, how to do that.
Good point.
They have rehearsed this sucker over and over again. I have followed this so closely over the years. Within 10 days of a supposed outbreak of a new disease that nobody has seen before, they know what virus caused it. That is the height of absurdity.
And they've got the vaccine almost ready to go.
Yeah, right. It's like, okay, pull up the trucks. Now that we've announced the germ, pull up the trucks, we've got the vaccine. This is a preposterous cover story that is totally false. Too long to go into. We've already gone into it many times, you and I. But what it does show you is that they know how to do this kind of propaganda. So what they could do, and this is one of the things that I have said there's a probability of as a prediction. You get some area somewhere out in the Midwest, perhaps, that's kind of, you know, you've got a few towns there, you've got a fairly significant population, but nothing unmanageable, and we've got an outbreak.
You drop it on them.
Yeah, you drop it. People are dying, people are sick. We cordon off the area with troops. We send in soldiers. We send in doctors from the CDC. We send in researchers, and they are promoted as the biggest heroes in the world that are desperately trying against all odds to solve the puzzle and save human lives. We don't know whether it's jumped the fence and the cordon here, and it might be spreading. We're not sure. We have a few cases that look like they might have showed up in Oregon, but, you know, blah, 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 blah. The media intensity is enormous. You've got cameras, you've got trucks, you've got reporters out in the field wearing bush jackets and reporting 24 hours a day on news channels about the outbreak. They've got a name for it. They said it's caused by a germ. They know it's a virus. They're working to find out what it is and how to cure it and how to vaccinate against it. And all the time, it's really a chemical. And only a few people know that. And they create the next phase, I would say, in this pandemic operation, which is really a kind of massive intelligence spy sort of scenario. And everybody falls for it completely. And the doctors are the heroes, and the families of the dead people are being interviewed endlessly, and the funerals are being held, and there are some lives being saved, etc. And after 15, 20 days, or whatever the lifespan of that chemical is, it goes away. It deteriorates. It goes into the soil, at which point they announce a triumph. Fantastic. The medical people have come through. This has saved, you know, the president gets on television and says, these men and women could have saved our nation.
They probably have flanked him in the news conference.
Oh, you bet. They flanked him. They're there from the CDC and the doctors, and they're getting medals, you know, the president's medal of this and that and the other thing. And now you've really got a ball game going on here. And you've prepared the population for the next one. And there's all kinds of PR and propaganda about how this could happen. Where did this virus come from? And they recycle some of the old propaganda about, well, air travel in the 21st century is ubiquitous and people from all over the world and blah, blah, blah. We think it came from China. We think it came from Mexico. We think it came from Africa. It's always someplace like that. They will never say, it came from Brooklyn.
Huh.
Why not? Why is it that it always comes from Africa or Mexico or, you know, Hong Kong? I remember in college, it was the Asian flu in 1958, and everybody around me was getting vaccinated like crazy. And for some reason, I don't know why to this day, I just said, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't want that needle, and I'm not going to get sick. And I didn't, and people were, you know, going to the infirmary all the time. Well, you got to condition the population over and over and over again. So you've got to tell them a fable, a fairy tale, a myth. Oh, yes, we think it came from Africa. We think it came from here. You know, and everybody goes, oh, yes, the great mystery. What was it? Did a human have sex with an animal, or did they eat a pig somewhere, and then it was transferred? You know, all this kind of myth-making. But never. It came from Rockefeller Plaza in New York. That was a skater in the rink. You're never going to hear that.
Why is it, John, that people, the camp that might not agree with you, they get so upset? You know, rather than just have dialogue and try to explain why they feel the way they do, they get very, very upset. It's almost as if the ability to speak and think in this country has gone by the wayside.
Yeah, I mean, that's been my experience. They do this because they've been trained to think that way. I mean, from the time that they go to college and they take biology courses and all the way through medical school, internship, residency, et cetera. I mean, this is, you know, talk about mind control and indoctrination. The germ theory is pounded into them. If somebody is sick, it's a germ. If somebody is sick, it's a particular disease caused by a particular germ, and if we can find out what it is, then we can make a drug against it and a vaccine to prevent it. This is what medicine is all about.
You got that right. John, stay with us. We're going to come back in a moment. We're going to take phone calls, but I also want to ask you about Dr. Barbara Starfield and have you explain for us the Starfield Report. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast. Stay on.